Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Sharice Stevens, bringing you today's Yuma Sun Daily, with a look at life in and around Yuma. Let's start with local news. Our first story is titled, Human Voice Delivers Powerful Message for AWC Student Journalist, by Michael Neary, Sun staff writer. Students at Arizona Western College are producing podcasts in a rigorous process that draws on both human expertise and all sorts of advanced digital technology. But they're also tapping something more basic, the human voice. I want to be a microphone for those voices that can't be heard, said Melanie Ruiz Lopez, co-host of the podcast Siendo Primero, which focuses on first-generation students. They need to be heard because we are having trouble out there and we're trying to be successful just as much as any other person out there. Ruiz hosts the podcast with Sahi Barcenas, one of two student podcasts available on KAWC's website. The other is KAWC's The Hot Spot. Although the podcasts are filled with diverse student perspectives, Barcenas noted that not all of the voices on the podcast are young ones. I know we're a part of that, the younger generation, but the voices that we have on the Siendo Primero can be of any age, she said. The first generation is not just the young people. The students are enrolled as interns in Journalism 289, taught by Dr. Tricia Campbell, a professor of English at AWC. Campbell noted unusually relevant qualifications for teaching a course in which much of the work revolves around preparing podcasts. My PhD is rhetoric, but I studied the rhetoric of sound, she said, as she described her passion for the human voice. During a recent class, students worked on an episode of Siendo Primero with Campbell as the guide. The process was rigorous, as students supplied each other with feedback and plotted strategies for future work. It was this sort of meticulous attention that separates these podcasts from the flood of social media that might otherwise surround people in cyberspace. Campbell suggested that the sort of work the students are doing could lie at the heart of any number of future endeavors. For me, it's so exciting, she said. It's applicable everywhere. Campbell underlined a kind of elemental power within the human voice. For me, there's nothing like the human voice, she said. My research is in empathy, and this is the closest we get to actual empathy. I'm obsessed with the human voice, and I see so much potential in the 21st century. After the class, students contemplated the role that voice plays for them. Equipped with laptops and plenty of editing software in a recent class, the students talked about honing their digital work in ways that would have been unheard of decades ago. But they also shared a fondness for the human voice in ways that called up images of old radios, uncluttered by computers or even television sets. It allows the brain to fill in the gap, said Maya Manry, a co-host of The Hotspot. Manry recalled a segment she did on recent protests against U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. She described a kind of connection that wells up when someone tells a story on the radio to a listener guided only by a voice. In that ICE episode, I say that among chanting protesters and honking cars, alone stands a man dressed in a luchador, she said. If you were to see it, you would see it. You would see everything. When I'm telling you, I kind of holding your hand along this. I'm telling you that there are honking cars and people, and your mental vision kind of points towards this person, and I'm making you see it. Chloe Michael, as a co-host of The Hotspot, described the way researching and telling a story through her own voice during Black History Month helped her see something new. I don't always know there was a school here that was originally meant as a segregated school, she said. Apparently, a lot of people in Yuma didn't know this either, because when I Googled it, nothing was there. So thanks to the show, I was able to get information out there that was really hard for me to find. The podcasts are touched by playful banter and humor, but they also dive into serious topics. Siendo Primero's podcast have included subjects such as depression in college and changing careers. And interviews have explored the gratitude first-generation students feel toward their family, as well as possible feelings of guilt
that might accompany their opportunities, in spite of the hard work they are doing.
Episodes from recent episodes of The Hotspot include topics such as Black History Month and building community, ICE in Yuma, and Gen Z on using their phones. The student podcasts themselves live exclusively online rather than in the mix of KAWC's on-air programs, but segments of their work can be channeled into on-air programs, giving students an added layer of experience. Cisco J. Stargazer, the education solutions reporter for KAWC, acts as a reporter mentor for the students working on the podcast. I focus a little bit on their content, the quality of it, and what is good for air, Stargazer said, noting that work might be drawn from the students' podcast for on-air broadcasts, particularly in the program Arizona Edition. We like to use their work, Stargazer said. I've been spending a little bit of time lately looking at the scripts and giving feedback. I want to make sure that it's a good story that can stand on its own. Max Schwitzing, a student who works on KAWC's The Hotspot, was at the college in 2024 when the KAWC Student Newsroom started its work, aided by a grant from the Local News Initiative of Southern Arizona. He and Elias Alvarez Iniguez, now a student at Northern Arizona University, were the first students working on the student newsroom as it now exists. Before 2024, students still contributed in various ways to the station. It was a really great learning experience, Schwitzing said of the student newsroom. It was cool to say, I'm getting experience in a professional setting that isn't really academic, but it's still very accessible because it's here at AWC. The student newsroom was first directed by retired KAWC News and Operations Director Lou Glum and Professor Kevin Cato. Most of the students working today are concentrating academically on subjects other than journalism. Mannery, however, is focusing on television production. It's always been a little kid's dream of, I want to make movies, she said. But now that I've actually done this, worked at the station, and seen the little bit of production, it does keep me interested. Ruiz Lopez is concentrating on the administration of justice in her schooling, and she sees connections between that work and her podcast. I want to advocate for people who are trying to speak but are not being heard, she said. When I got this chance, I thought, yes, it's what I've been wanting to do. And after I do become a lawyer, I want to advocate for those people. I still want to make great opportunities for them. Michael has combined theater with secondary education in her college studies, fields that may very well combine in her future. She found the station through the advice of a friend. It was a place, she said, that she hadn't intended to relish, but she did. I was not expecting to like it as much as I do, she said. Michael noted that along with her interest in teaching and theater, radio holds a place in her hopes. I'm keeping that in my back pocket now, she said. I really like this. I see how much it connects, and I like that. Bracinas is concentrating on computer graphics in her studies, but the visual focus of those studies does not, as she tells it, lie far away from her auditory work in radio. I love that balance, she said. If it's a video or radio, it's editing. You're using so many tools to reach your goal. People interested in more information about the podcast, including students who would like to participate, can contact Stargazer at sisko.stargazer@kawc.org. Those who like to listen to podcasts can find them at www.kawc.org under the drop-down menu for podcast. Next up in local news, San Luis to pursue state grant for walking and cycling path by Sesonoyoy, Bajo el Sol. San Luis officials are seeking state funding to help plan a nearly 5-mile walking and biking path along the East Main Canal. The City Council voted March 25 to authorize the Economic Development Department to apply for a $500,000 through the Arizona Department of Transportation's Transportation Alternatives Program. Economic Development Director Armando Esparza told council members the money would fund a preliminary study for the proposed East Main Canal Shared Use Path project. The study would include data collection and field research, evaluation of design alternatives, environmental and impact assessments, and preparation of a final report. The report would be used to develop cost estimates and guide future construction planning for the path, which would run from County 22nd Street Southwest to Ertizua Stegwe Street. The project would create nearly 5 miles of shared-use trail intended to improve pedestrian and bicycle access between key destinations in the community. City officials said the proposal aligns with the Parks, Trails, and Pathways Master Plan approved by the San Luis City Council in September 2024. Esparza said the grant would require a 5.7% local match, or about $28,500. If approved, the funding would become available in fiscal year 2027. In this week's edition of In the Field, Smarter Canals Water Districts Tap into Automation by Yuma County Cooperative Extension. In the heart of one of the world's most productive agricultural hubs, the future of water management is moving from manual cranks to digital set points. On Thursday, March 26, the Yuma Agricultural Center hosted Rubicon Upskill, a specialized intensive training designed to help local water districts master the new automated gate technology available to them. As farm use of Colorado River water faces increasing scrutiny, this event focused on solutions towards precision. John Lind, an account manager for Rubicon Water, led the training for several Yuma area irrigation districts that have integrated Rubicon's automated gates into their infrastructure. The primary advantage is that districts get much finer control of their water and accurate flow assessment, Lind explained. It helps the district use less water and direct it more accurately in the long run. The gates operate via SCADA, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Software, allowing districts to monitor and change flows instantly. According to Lind, this provides a constant stream of data regarding how much water is being diverted at any given second. Gravity meets intelligence. For the Yuma County Water Users Association, the transition to smart infrastructure is already underway. Currently, operating two gates with plans for more, the association sees automation as the key to modernizing their gravity-fed system, which pulls water from the All-American Canal and siphons it under the Colorado River into the Yuma Valley. The gates are smart. You just have to put in a flow valve or an upstream valve, and the gate will automatically maintain those valves, said Mark Shelton of the Yuma County Water Users Association. We feel Rubicon is innovative, and it's going to help us in our flow efficiency. Way of the future. The Bard Water District has been using the technology for over 5 years. With 7 gates installed, the district is focusing on in-house maintenance instead of outsourcing. Sean Weddle of Bard Water District noted that impact on the daily lives of the ditch riders who were traditionally responsible for manual gate adjustments. It's an extra tool. These gates can operate themselves, Weddle said. I can look at the sites standing here right now without getting out there. If something happens, too much water, too little water, I get an alert and I know right now. As water scarcity remains a defining challenge for the Western agriculture, the consensus among attendees was clear. Precision is needed. Technology is where it's at, Weddle added. We've got to start moving that way because it allows us to be more accurate with our water measurement. You are listening to the Yuma Sun Daily with Sharice Stevens on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Our first story in state news is titled, Election Officials in Oregon and Arizona Are First to Pledge Legal Challenges to New Trump Voting Order. Associated Press. Election officials in Oregon and Arizona are the first to pledge legal challenges to new Trump voting order. Next in state news, Arizona launches AI camera network to spot wildfires easily, by Howard Fisher, Capital Media Services. State fire officials unveiled a new network of cameras using artificial intelligence on Friday in hopes of spotting wildfires before they get too big. That network, at least as far as the Department of Forestry and Fire Management itself is concerned, is not very big. It currently amounts to just 7 cameras, mostly in Mojave County and Southeast Arizona. But Russ Schumate, the agency's deputy director of operations, said it's designed to mesh with cameras that already are operated in forest areas by Arizona Public Service and Tucson Electric Power to look out for wildfires, all totaled, according to fire officials, that makes close to 50. We put them in areas where they weren't, or we're never going to be, he said. So, for example, Schumate said, the decision to put cameras in Mojave County is directly related to the fact that APS does not serve the area. More to the point, data from the cameras run both by the state and utilities is fed into his agency's dispatch center. While it avoids the need for full-time spotters living in those fire towers that have traditionally been placed on hilltops, he doesn't replace the human factor. As Schumate explained, the cameras are programmed to look for any unusual smoke. It's deciding whether it sees a fire or not, he said. What it does at that point is flags us, and we start looking, Schumate explained. But not everything the camera spot and the artificial intelligence flags is actually the beginning of a forest fire. It might be a prescribed fire, he said, or it might even be just dust or a vehicle going down a hill. The decision-making comes in after it gets flagged. All this comes as John Truitt, the state's fire management officer, warned that this could be a particularly bad year for fires. This year, we expect the season to ramp up quickly in the southern and southeast areas of Arizona due to long-term dryness and the fine fuel loading, he said. The abundant moisture that we had in the fall has led to an abundant grass crop, Truitt said. And those grass crops are already curing out and ready to go. And the rest of the state? Truitt said that by May, the problems will move north toward the Mogollon Rim and up into the pine types at our higher elevations. But he also said there is a very heavy grass crop in the Prescott and Chino Valley areas. Complicating matters, Truitt said it's tree mortality, with dry conditions making trees, especially the ponderosa pines, particularly at risk of infestation from beetles. We have thousands of acres of dead pine trees out there that are just waiting to explode, he said. And there's something else that's different this year. Normally, the Southwest will be the first thing to start burning in the West, Truitt said. But this year, if you look at the maps, all the West is ready to burn. What makes that important is that Arizona, like other states, depends on help from others, including the Bureau of Land Management for federal lands. So we're going to be in a very stiff competition here in the next few weeks for resources, Truitt said. As to those cameras keeping an eye out for wildfires, Schumate said they have their limitations. Human towers can see farther out than AI towers, he said. But about a 10-mile limit on the camera's ability to reliably spot smoke. And there's something else. Schumate said those fire towers have traditionally been placed at mountain peaks, providing the broadest view. But the cameras, he said, tend to be at the same level as the surrounding forest because of how they work in detecting smoke. Our last state news story is titled, Arizona Moves to Repeal Cesar Chavez State Holiday by Howard Fisher, Capital Media Services. Governor Katie Hobbs will sign legislation repealing the state holiday that had honored labor leader Cesar Chavez. Press aide Christian Slater made the statement just hours after the House approved the repeal with just 8 dissenting votes. All said they agreed with the majority but objected to the refusal of Republicans to consider renaming the holiday, set for March 31 each year to honor the farm worker movement. The announcement of the governor's intent also came despite a last-ditch bid by Senator Sally Ann Gonzalez. The lone negative vote when it cleared the Senate last Thursday to get Hobbs to veto it. Gonzalez, like the 8 Democrats who voted against the measure, said she agrees that Chavez, accused of sexually assaulting at least 2 young girls in the farm worker movement in the 1970s, does not deserve the recognition. The Tucson Democrat said, however, it was wrong of Senate Republicans to allow a vote on several of her proposals. One would have designated March 31st as a farm worker day and encouraged Arizonans to pay tribute to the farm workers of the state, both past and present, for their extraordinary contributions to the labor and civil rights movements. But Gonzalez, in her letter to Hobbs, said action on the bill crafted in a way to take effect the moment the governor signs it is illegal.
The key to immediate action is for lawmakers to approve a measure with a two-thirds vote. What happened here with the 48-8 vote in the House on Monday, allowing the 29-1 approval by the Senate last week. It also has to include an emergency clause. HB 2072 has it. But Gonzalez said the Arizona Constitution says such clauses are allowed only if the measure separately states why it is necessary that it shall become immediately effective. Instead, the senator said the legislation contains just boilerplate language, declaring it an emergency measure that is necessary to preserve the public peace, health, or safety, and nothing more. About the closest need to an emergency is that state law, approved in 2000, designated March 31 every year, the birth date of the labor leader, as a holiday. But it is an unpaid holiday, akin to similar laws for Arbor Day and Purple Heart Day. There was no immediate response from the governor's office to the letter. The dissenting House Democrats, who spoke Monday, all said it was necessary to act quickly to send the message that the state should not be honoring someone who the New York Times reported sexually abused two girls in the 1970s. Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, also said she was coerced to have sex by Chavez once and raped once. But they agreed with Gonzalez that it was disrespectful of the Senate Republicans, who rapidly crafted the outright repeal last week, to not consider Democratic proposals to also rename the day on behalf of farm workers. "We have people in the movement like my grandparents. They were doing the work," said Representative Anna Abatia. "Some of the people were just the face of things," said the Phoenix Democrat. "And not including us in the conversation is honestly super disrespectful, and it hurts the people that are still alive today that have done the work. I just can't in good faith support something that does not honor the people who made the movement possible," said Tucson Democratic Representative Consuelo Hernandez. "Just outright repealing this is not a thing I can stand for," said Representative Alma Hernandez, also a Tucson Democrat. Others, however, said it was more important to act immediately to honor the girls who were victimized by Chavez, even though the bill made no mention of the farm worker movement. "When we heard the news that two women had come forward, and later Dolores Huerta reporting that they had been sexually abused by Cesar Chavez, I and many around the country believed them," said Representative Patty Contreras. "We quickly moved to condemn his actions by removing his name and likeness from murals, street names, statues, and buildings." The Phoenix Democrat said she is disappointed by Chavez, but she used the opportunity to make a political point. "I'm also disappointed that the voices of many women who were sexually assaulted as girls are not being heard," she said. "Release the Epstein files." House Minority Leader Oscar de los Santos, who voted for the repeal of the holiday, also used the opportunity to argue that despite a federal law and assurances from the Department of Justice, there appear to be many pieces missing from the files of what the federal government knows about the actions, about the abuse and rape of young girls, not just by Epstein, but by others in his orbit.
That is all the time we have for this article as we wrap up this section of the Yuma Sun Daily. Now for recent Yuma obituaries. Lynn Martin, 49, Yuma. Mary Elva Myers, 92, Yuma. Sun Sounds extends condolences to the families and loved ones. The weather forecast for this week, starting with today, Wednesday, April 1st, will have a low of 64 degrees, a high of 84 degrees, average humidity of 34%, and winds in the 8 to 17 mile per hour range. Thursday will see a low of 57, a high of 85, average humidity 31%, and 3 to 12 mile per hour winds. Friday, the low will be 59 degrees, the high 86, average humidity is 16%, and winds are in the 4 to 20 mile per hour range. Saturday will have a low of 62, a high of 89, average humidity 12%, and 5 to 10 mile per hour winds. All of this week, the UV index will be high to very high, as rated by the World Health Organization, who also recommends sun protection daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We are at the conclusion of today's Yuma Sun Daily program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Sharice Stevens. Thank you for tuning in today. If you missed any part of this program, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and listen to it on demand under broadcast info and audio. The Wall Street Journal is next on Sun Sounds of Arizona.